Welcome to In It to Win It. This is Steve Barton, and thank you for tuning in. I am back with Justin Huhn of Uranium Insider. Justin, thanks for coming back on the show.
Good to see you, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing quite well, sir. Quite well. Thanks for coming on. We might be interesting for the listener. You and I live pretty close together. I saw you on Silver Chartist, and I think that's how I reached out. And then come to find out, we're only 30 minutes from each other. So we had lunch the other week. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah, you're practically my neighbor.
I know.
The fact
I used to work with your mom. I'm like,
yeah.
I've only ever known one other Huhn in my life. And I was like, is that his mom?
There aren't, really? There aren't that many of us. I think there's more of us in Germany, but not too many in the States. I've only known one other that wasn't direct family in my whole life. So yeah. Yeah, small world.
Oh, it is a super small world, super small world. Okay. Oh, I got to apologize. I got some construction going on here. I'm trying to get some place ready to rent. So you might hear some construction.
No worries. I actually can't hear it. So no problem.
Good. Okay. Uranium. We're at a $50 spot price. Spot is down to a 12 or 13% discount to NAV, meaning it's a really good deal. I watched the Uranium Conference 4.0. Awesome. You know, and come to think of it, I'll put a link in the show notes so that the listener can go through and listen to it. It's 4 hours long. Justin does a probably a 20-minute bit on there. Just some heavy hitters in the uranium space. Really, really good material. One thing I really liked about it was when John Trapaglia came on and he talked about how he was giving a speech to some of the potential fuel buyers. And they were under the impression that this Sprott Physical Uranium Trust would be open for them to purchase at some point. They were calculating this 57 million pounds as part of the supply. And he had to politely tell them, that's not correct. It's not available for sale or for lending. You know, our investors, you know, are using this as an asset that is not to be sold. And I told that to Rick Rule, and he said the same kind of thing. He said he had a conversation recently with a big utility, and they were telling him how the SPUT was an ETF. And I'm like, wow, these are the people that are buying this, and they don't even understand what the trust is. That kind of leads me to the conclusion, correct me if I'm wrong, but I see this sector as similar to silver, and that this could be the opportunity of a generation. People just don't know it yet.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, but I generally believe, agree with you on that. It's especially right now, considering the market conditions and how they're juxtaposed with some of the things that you just spoke about, the SPUT and where the spot price is at, and some of the developments that have happened, least of which would be not only the emergence of the SPUT vehicle, but the invasion of the Ukraine by Russia and the resultant reaction from the West, essentially, to that invasion, has really set up a very, very interesting and exciting moment in time for an investor in a lot of various resources. But uranium is one of them that has just this stack upon stack upon stack of positive fundamentals that juxtaposed with a 50% pullback from the recent highs of last autumn. So there's a major sale happening right now in uranium stocks, and it continues to happen even on a day like this. And I'll have to correct you, the SPUT discount to NAV right now is probably pushing about 19% today, because it's traded down about 4%-ish. I haven't looked at the charts in about 30 minutes, but about 4% on the day, and the actual spot price jumped up, gosh, $1.50 this morning. So the spot price is up, let's say 2%, and the spot vehicle is down 4%, and it closed yesterday at a 14%, 15% discount to NAV. So we're pushing between 18 and 20% discount to net asset value right now, which is historically the largest discount it's ever been at. So on that note, I actually bought a pretty chunky size of it today. I sold down some stuff that was just dead money in my portfolio to create some cash to scoop that up, because that kind of discount, we've never seen it. And historically that does get closed, and I'm confident that it will as well going forward.
Yeah. You know what? After I get off this call with you, then I'm going to sell some more oil and, pick up some more spot. That I've never seen 19%. The biggest I've seen is 15.9 or like 16%.
Right.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Pretty yeah. Cool. Indeed. Yeah.
And at a time when Japanese restarts are beginning, and Rick was saying that you know, for a long time he was saying that the price of uranium will move when Japan restarts their nuclear fleet. He just didn't know when that was going to be, and we do now. It's 2022 and 2023. So they've got 33 total reactors, correct? 10 have been restarted, so meaning we got 23 more to go.
That sounds about right. I think that there's a little bit more than that. Okay, so they had, I think it was 53 total reactors at the time of Fukushima. And I believe around a dozen of those have been permanently decommissioned. Okay. So of the remaining that have not been restarted, there's roughly somewhere around 30, between 30 and 33. I apologize, I don't have those numbers exact, but that could in theory be restarted. And they have restarted 10. There's an 11th that's going to restart in the first quarter of 2023. There's an 11th that's going to restart this year. And then I believe it's a 12th that's going to restart early part of next year. So, you know, the process always takes longer than everybody expects with these things. But there's about a dozen reactors that are in the process, if not more, actually, that are in the process of restarting. It's somewhere along the way of that process. And most of it has to do with reviews, has to do with just reviewing the safety precautions and getting the, the governor of each prefecture to sign off on it, et cetera, making sure that the surrounding communities are in favor of it. So it's a longer process than most people think, but now we're seeing just very strong language coming from the newly elected Prime Minister Kishida, who basically is saying, we're gonna do everything we can to restart these things as fast as possible. We've got not only just an energy crisis, but they're getting hit with a heat wave right now. So they're going to do what they can to restart these faster. And if you project out their goals, which are likely to be accelerated, which are to have 20 to 22% of their energy grid nuclear by 2030, that's another 20 reactors to restart, in addition to the 10 that are already restarted. So, and that's only 8 years away, 7.5 years away. So if they accelerate that, let's say to a 5-year timeline for another, besides the two that are already set to restart. So that's another 18 plus reactors in the next 5 years. That's really, really big. And considering what's going on in the world and the public sentiment in Japan, to restart nuclear as fast as possible is now in the majority. Polls are showing close to 60% of the public wants nuclear back.
Good.
So add to that the actual language coming from the federal government of Japan. It's just a perfect storm for these things to come back online faster than anyone expected. So Rick Rule, you know, called it a long time ago. And honestly, I was amongst a number of people who were critiquing that thesis, basically, that, oh, the bull market will finally get going when the reactors restart. So I think, you know, he might have missed the first leg or two of this market. But, you know, I think we still have a really, really big moves ahead of us. So to some extent, I think that he's right. Yeah.
Yeah. It now 20 to 22% nuclear for Japan by 2030. What are they at now? Do you know, like 5 or 10 or something?
I don't know. It's probably closer to 5, because if they were maybe somewhere between 5 and 10, actually. So if they have 10 reactors restarted, they did another 20, would get them to 20%. So they're probably at about 6 or 7% nuclear, would be my guess. Unless, of course, they're projecting expansion of the grid during that time frame. So maybe they are closer to, 10%.
What kind of annual demand is that on the metal, those 10 reactors? Is that like 20 million pounds or what would it be?
Well, for a 1,000 megawatt reactor, that's about 440,000 pounds of U308 per year. That's rough. It really depends on the reactor design. It depends on the efficiency, et cetera. But that's a kind of a ballpark for a 1,000 megawatt reactor. Some of these reactors in Japan that are going to be restarted are not quite that large. So let's say another 20 reactors. That's about, let's just say 7, let me do the math here really quick. 500,000 pounds would be 5 million, £500,000 per 1,000 megawatts. And if that's 20, we're looking at about, let's say, 6 or 7 million pounds a year of demand, okay. Additional demand, ballparking.
Nice. Okay. That's cool. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
And you mentioned something too. You said Japan can store a decade's worth of energy in a warehouse.
Right.
You can't do that with coal. You can't do that with natural gas. You can't do that with the.
Yeah. Japan doesn't have a lot in terms of natural resources and energy resources. So, you know, they import essentially everything that they need to have an electrical grid, period. You know, they have a very small amount of hydro. So they import a lot of coal, they import a lot of natural gas, and they import uranium. They haven't imported uranium in a while because of Fukushima, because of all the reactors that have come down, because of the existing inventories that they had at the time. So there's probably been a decent amount of trading of inventories back and forth, selling of inventories by utilities that have decommissioned reactors to utilities that have reactors that were being restarted, assuming that the reactor design was the same. And there has been some inventory being sold into the market by the Japanese over the past decade. So that's definitely been happening. I don't think it's been a huge number, but, you know, somewhere to the tune of, let's say, 3 to 5 million pounds a year would probably be a safe guess. Now, I think that's diminished over the past couple of years because of the expectation of these restarts. But yeah, it's not only a demand story, it's also a supply story. So going forward, and this, of course, depends on the type of inventories held and by which utilities, but we should expect to see less, if any, inventory from Japan being sold into the open market, considering their restart plan.
Yeah, that seems like a bad idea from their perspective to sell the fuel that they're going to need.
Right, yeah. And to your point about the concentration, I mean, uranium is just so concentrated with coal and with natural gas. You know, they have to keep those shipments, you know, just coming in constantly in order to burn through that fuel, keep the grid going. For uranium, you know, they can contract out multiple years of fabricated fuel of EUP and store that in a very, very small place, a very small area. And that can be, you know, a high degree of energy security for the Japanese. So no doubt they are fully aware of that. And that has likely something to do with their increased conviction for restarting these plants, especially with the rising costs of both coal and natural gas.
Yeah. What are some of these? So a plant will essentially place an order that may get filled over the course of a few years, right? They're not paying $50 a pound for this stuff, right? They have to negotiate and go, okay, we're going to pay $62 a pound for the next 2 years or something like that. Is that accurate?
The primary way that, historically speaking, and increasingly now that utilities have procured fuel for the reactors is through long-term contracts. And they'll do that with actual producers. And then, of course, with the suppliers of the fuel cycle services between the mined uranium and the fabricated fuel. And they'll do that sometimes in piecemeal, sometimes they'll do it all in a one-stop shop. Like, for example, in years past, a utility could go straight to Uranium One and contract for their U308, for their conversion, for their enrichment, and their fabricated fuel, all from the same supplier, essentially from the Russians. And there's different entities that are state-owned Russian companies. But you could make one phone call and have all elements of the fuel cycle contracted and delivered to you out to whatever time frame you contract. In some cases, and that's happening a lot right now, utilities will actually contract for a single or one or two elements of the fuel cycle at a time piecemeal. So rather than going to one or multiple entities at the same time to contract, okay, I'm going to buy my U308, I'm going to buy my conversion, buy my enrichment, buy my fab fuel, I'm going to do that all in one fell swoop. And that would happen under normal circumstances, right? So let's say 5 years ago, one of the big utilities, if they wanted to secure their fuel for 2025 to 2030, they would go to a producer like Kazatomprom or Cameco and secure their U308, Cameco, their conversion. Then they'd go to the French or the Russians to secure their enrichment and their fabricated fuel. And so that would be under normal circumstances. But what's happening right now is, and does also happen under normal circumstances, but to a lesser extent, what's happening right now is because there's all of these geopolitical uncertainties with Russia being impacted by this invasion and the resultant policy changes by the Western countries, by the EU and the US, the utilities are seeing a crunch in both conversion and enrichment because Russia is such a huge provider of those two services, the biggest globally. 30th percentile for conversion, low 40th percentile for enrichment in terms of total global capacity. So that's a huge, huge change. So what utilities in the West are doing now, and by the West makes up something 70 to 75% of total global nuclear energy capacity. So to put it simply, the bulk of the buyers of uranium stuff is in the West, but the largest players of this uranium stuff are in the East. So that's Kazatomprom for the U308, and that's Russia for conversion and enrichment. Interestingly enough, Kazatomprom or Kazakhstan and Russia, Kazakhstan around 40% of total uranium production, Russia around 40% of conversion and enrichment. Kind of interesting. I just realized that all that number's pretty close for all those three elements. So what the utilities in the West are doing now are scrambling for UF6 and conversion, EUP and enrichment, because that's the piece that's most highly implicated by Russia being effectively cut off from the West. And that's also the further down the fuel cycle elements that they can get fuel into their reactors sooner. So if you're a utility and you happen to be uncovered in terms of your nuclear fuel, which is the fabricated fuel, that's ultimately the thing that they need, right? But yeah, they have to oftentimes, most times actually figure out all of the other pieces to get it there. But the fabricated fuel is the thing that they actually need for the reactors. And they hold inventories all throughout the fuel cycle, and they hold those inventories all around the world. So a utility in the US might have some UF6 held at Cameco's Port Hope, and they might have some EUP held in France, and they might have some fabricated fuel held at their own location, and they have a contract for some U308 from a producer. And all of these things are considered inventory. Not necessarily the unmined material, but anything that's above ground that's held at any place around the world and at any stage of the fuel cycle is part of their inventory. So just to kind of wrap this rambling rant up into a point, the prices of conversion and enrichment of UF6 and EUP have skyrocketed over the past 3 months. We've seen just huge, huge moves in all elements of this, especially spot SWU, which is the service of enrichment less than 12 months time period, has gone absolutely bonkers. In fact, it's close to twice the cost of long-term SWU, which is the cost of enrichment in a long-term contract. All of this is to say that what we're seeing right now is this scrambling for that material further down the fuel cycle, and the utilities figuring out how much capacity is going to be available to them going out in the future from Western suppliers of conversion and enrichment, essentially prior to buying that U308. And so U308 purchased on the spot market is not a common activity, let's say, by the nuclear utilities. It does happen. It's a minority percentage by a significant amount. Most of the spot market volume now is SPUD, more than 50%. Prior to SPUT's existence, most of the spot market activity was traders trading pounds literally back and forth. And if you go back even, let's say, 2+ years, what you'll find is a lot of the spot market activity was carry traders. So these are utilities signing long-term contracts with a trader, and the trader would go ahead and procure those elements from the fuel cycle, and in particular the U308 and UF6. So that's a very convoluted and complex way to say that there's all this pressure now from the West as being the bulk of the buyers of uranium fuel products, purchasing from Western suppliers of conversion enrichment and eventually of U308. And we've already seen more attention being paid to Cameco. They're the primary producer of uranium in the West. But it's a very exciting situation where you can see very, very clearly what is about to happen. And then you place that against a backdrop of a bloodbath in the financial markets. And it's so amazing to see. It's so amazing to see. And myself and, you know, and all of the fundies are bullish. I mean, all of the guys that are uranium focused funds or funds that at least are heavily invested in uranium are really, really excited. I mean, recently speaking with Art Hyde from SEGRA, they're, you know, he didn't release the actual letter that went out to their clients, but basically the title of the letter was Fix Bayonets. And he's basically like, these guys are seeing, when you compare the what has changed since March 2020 of the fundamentals and how the equities are now valued relative to that fundamental backdrop, it's like there's blood in the streets right now. And the smart guys and the guys that know more than anyone about this sector, more than me, that's the Segras, that's the Marcelos, Marcelo Lopez from L2. There was, I don't know if you watched that fireside chat from Red Cloud. You should you should post a link to it in this episode because it's
okay.
It's
give me the link and I'll put it in the
last notes. Week. Okay. It was a Red Cloud. It was a fireside chat. It was very short. It was less than 30 minutes. It was Mike Alkin from Station Cove, Marcelo Lopez from L2, and Guy Keller from Tribeca. These are all uranium focused. Station Cove is entirely uranium, as far as I know. Marcelo Lopez is. It was very highly focused uranium. He sold out of most of it, I believe, last year, and now they're getting back in pretty aggressively. And then Tribeca, I believe, is predominantly focused on uranium. But these three guys were in a chat together, and they were breathing fire. I mean, absolutely breathing fire. And it's so interesting to see the different attitudes coming from the very, very smart, very well-read, very competent people that know almost everything there is to know about uranium and happen to manage hundreds of millions of dollars, their attitudes relative to the retail guy who went in a little bit too heavy last fall and is just absolutely panicking and bummed out right now. And both of those things are real and they exist, and that's sentiment and that's human emotion. But the people that know where this is going are getting very greedy right here. Yeah.
I'm really excited. Totally. This is going to be so much fun. But I remember when we were having lunch, you, me, and Daniel, we were talking about other investments. You're obviously heavily weighted towards uranium, but what are some other, things you hold?
Right now, honestly, I lightened up on almost everything. I do think that It's such a strange set of circumstances here. I do think that long term, I'm bullish on a lot of commodities and metals. In the short term, I think that recessionary pressures are likely to put downward pressure on oil and gas and copper, and possibly everything else. But I can't not be long uranium here because of how everything is set up and because of how much it's already sold off. But I'm still very bullish. I'm very bullish on silver, but I have no idea of the timeline. I mean, if I could buy vertical call spreads for 2025, I would, but I can't. In 2024, is that long enough of a time frame? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I know it's going to go and it's going to go hard, but is it next week or is it 3 years from now? I don't know. I just don't know. I don't think anybody knows. And that's been the ultimate pain trade. So the fact that it's been so painful for basically everybody makes me bullish. So I really like silver. I think if we're talking longer term, I love the high dividend paying kind of global mining stocks like Vale and BHP.
Rio Tinto.
Yes, exactly. And I like copper for the long term. I'm assuming that the world continues to go in the electrify everything direction. That should be very, very bullish for copper. I like silver and gold for the long term. I like oil. I honestly think whatever recessionary pressure goes towards oil and gas in the next, let's say, 1 to 3, 4, 5-ish months is going to be a very, very strong buy the dip. Which I intend to, and I don't know when it's going to reverse, and I'm fine with missing that bottom 10% move. But for now, I went to a decent amount of cash in almost everything else that I hold, with an exception of uranium. And I do have some spreads on silver still.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited for silver. I think that was going to be
a generational
move right there. You know, it's just, everything is lining up so well for it.
Yeah. But, I have three different accounts, that I trade. And one of those I don't touch. It's just like, it's where I hold, Vale, Rio, BHP and things like that. It's just like, I just let it sit there. And if it corrects 40%, I don't care. I don't even look at it. I have an automated deposit that goes into it of an amount. This is my secret sauce here. It doesn't matter how much you earn, automate deposits into your investing accounts in an amount that is negligible to you. Make sure that it's amount that, and I'm not speaking to you directly, but just like whoever's watching this, make sure it's an amount of money that you know you are highly, highly unlikely to ever need to go and get that money out. Because if you get too aggressive with depositing into that account and it creates a situation where you might have to pull it out, guarantee that's going to come at a time when you don't want to take it out. You know,
and all like, the taxes you got to pay and everything are just
taxes you have to pay on it. And if your financial situation forces you to have to trade in a way that is antithetical to how you should be based on the movements of the market, like when the market corrects 30, 40%, if you're in these resource stocks and you need that money out, that's painful.
Yeah.
That's painful.
That's a horrible
that's
time.
That's the exact time you do. So that's my secret sauce, is I have automated deposits into my accounts, and it's an amount that I don't even notice. Okay. And it's not a lot of money, but over time it accumulates. So every couple of months I'll go into this long-term account that I don't touch. And if something I like is red, I buy it with whatever cash is sitting there. That's just how I trade that one account. And that's worked phenomenally for me. Honestly, that account is outperforming the one that I'm actively trading on all the time, but I just have that to keep my monkey mind busy. Yeah. While the actual money maker is over here, you know, ignoring.
I do the same thing, dollar cost average, you know, just once a month, boom, it auto deposits. And then, like you said, once you get a good correction, then I put the cash to work. I like that. Do you have any agriculture? I know we talked a little bit about
actually, I do. I am holding, I'm holding a fertilizer stock. I forgot about that.
Nutrien? Yeah.
I'm holding a stock called CVR Partners.
Oh, okay.
UAN is the ticker. I'm bullish on fertilizer, obviously. I think we're likely to see a very troubling food crisis going forward. And I think that fertilizer prices are going to continue to have some loft under them, most likely.
Yeah. I placed a bet on land, L-A-N-D, it's a bit farmland.
I don't own that one, but I'm aware of it. I owned it a while back and I don't remember why I sold it, but it went up a lot after I sold it. I remember liking it.
And technically it looks pretty good right now. It's just, it came right back down to, with the liquidation crisis. Right on. Cool. Well, thank you, Justin. This was a lot of fun. You guys, please like and subscribe the video, get the word out, and go to uraniuminsider.com and get all things Justin. Justin, thanks again for coming on the show. You have a good rest of the day, sir.
My pleasure. Good to see you, Steve.
You too. Take care.